We do have a handout page. If you didn't get one of those and you'd like to have one of those, if you raise your hand, Mike will bring you one. We're going to be looking at the opening chapters of the book of Hosea tonight. And you know, one of the very unusual things about Hosea is that his family was his message. He had to sort of live out his prophecy in a most dramatic and painful way. And so his life is going to talk about the family of God, God's people, and how God's people betray God. And it's a very powerful and painful story for Hosea, and it is a powerful and painful story for God, because his people aren't faithful to him very well. And so we're going to have a discussion tonight. I'm going to open this up periodically for dialogue, and we're going to talk about Hosea's experience with his family. As you can see, I have a note there under the title, and it reminds us that Hosea has a special ministry to the 10 northern tribes. So remember, we've divided the kingdom now. We have the 10 tribes up north, and they're going to fall to Assyria in 721 or 722 BC. And that means that now after that time, you'll only have the nation of Judah, the two southern tribes, no more 10 northern tribes called Israel. But in Hosea's lifetime, he's primarily dealing with the 10 northern tribes. And so that's a little bit unique because he's right at the very end of their existence as a nation. And his life is all about foretelling what's going to happen when Assyria comes and how it's going to be part of God's judgment. You see Hosea's lifetime, you see the heading there. He's ministering about 750 to 700 BC. That makes him a contemporary of Isaiah. So Isaiah and Hosea are undoubtedly buddies. They know each other and are familiar with one another's ministries. You'll see from the opening verse, which I provided for you there, the word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. So when you look at those kings, you see he was there for the reign of Uzziah. I've given you the dates there. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, all good kings except Ahaz. He's evil. And of course, down the list, when we say Jeroboam and his line, that's the nation of Israel, 10 northern tribes, and they don't have any good kings. So up there, they're all bad. All right, so let's look at Hosea's unusual family and its significance. We're pointing out in the first place, sure, he's the son of Beeri, but we don't know anything about Beeri. So that's a dead end as far as giving us any insight. But then we come to verse 2. And here's what it says, and I've provided it for you again. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. The Lord said to Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So here he is. He's not even married yet. And the Lord says, you're going to have to take a wife who's going to be a prostitute. Now, we think she's not a prostitute yet. She's going to become a prostitute after they marry. But Hosea knows what's going to become of her because the Lord told him. So he says, you're going to marry somebody and you're going to love her, but she's going to turn into a prostitute. And not only that, you're going to have children of prostitution. In other words, they're not Hosea's children. They are his wife's children, but not his children. So he's told, even in the engagement period, what's going to happen once he marries and how this is going to go down. And we're told in verse 2 why this is going to happen halfway through the verse. For the land of Israel has committed great whoredom against me, God says, departing from the Lord. So you are going to be an object lesson. When everybody sees how awful you feel about your family situation, they're going to know how awful I feel about my family situation. And you're going to live it. You're going to hurt the way I hurt. And everybody will see how you hurt. And then they'll understand. So he has to live his prophecy. And so he does. Arabic 3 there in your notes. Hosea and his wife Gomer had one son together. That son's name is Jezreel. And you see, I provided the bulleted point for you. Jezreel's name means God plants. You see the word El at the end of Jezreel's name, that's God. So God plants. And the idea is that this son is going to grow up as an object lesson about God planting judgment. He's going to put judgment in the ground, and then judgment is going to be harvested. And that's why Jezreel is given the name God plants. Well, we have the verses there. And so look at verse 3. So he went to Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived Barim a son. The Lord said, call his name Jezreel for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, one of the kings, evil king, and I will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. So that's the 10 northern tribes, right? In 722, they cease to be a kingdom. And every time they see Jezreel, they're going to say, oh, yes, God did plant judgment, and now the kingdom is going to cease. In verse 5, it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So nobody can win the fight. The Lord is planting, and nobody can stop the planting. Nobody can stop the harvest of judgment that's coming. So that's Jezreel. Let's keep going. Arabic number 4. This is second child. This is a daughter, and her name is Lo Ruhamah, which means no mercy. The word lo in Hebrew is no or not. No, Ruhamah, mercy. No mercy. The daughter was to live as an object lesson for the removal of God's mercy. God saying, I'm not going to have mercy any longer. The verses again I've provided for you. See in verse 6, she conceived again and bare a daughter, and God said unto him, call her name Lo Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy, no mercy upon the house of Israel. I will utterly take them away. So that's Assyria coming 722 BC and conquering them. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, the two southern tribes down south. He says, I'm going to let them exist. And as you know, they would go on until 586. So a lot longer than 722. And I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor sword, nor battle, or horses, or horsemen. I'm going to save Judah. I'm not going to save the 10 northern tribes. Well, there's a really good chance that this daughter, Lo Ruhamah, is a daughter of whoredom. Pretty good chance this is not the daughter, the rightful daughter of Hosea. And so there's no mercy. Well, it's even worse, Arabic number 5. A third child, this time another boy. Finally, Gomer had a third child, another son who probably was not Hosea's son. His name was Lo-Ami, which means not my people. This son was to live as an object lesson to demonstrate God's rejection of Israel. Well, nothing. I mean, can you imagine? You take your little boy out in his carrier seat or whatever they had in those days. And everybody looks at your baby and say, oh, what a nice baby. Now, what did you name this baby? Well, I named this baby, he's not mine. Ooh, Lo-Ami, he's not my people. Wow, that's quite a moniker to hang on somebody. And everywhere he went, they would have to put the pieces together. I'm sure Gomer has a reputation by now. Oh, this baby, this is not mine. This is not Hosea's baby, not my people. And so there's shame in that, humiliation. And every time the people heard the name of Hosea's baby, they would say, oh, that's what God is doing to us. God says, not my people, you're not my people. Well, so number 6 there in your notes. So Gomer continued in her prostitution, eventually being divorced by Hosea and leaving home altogether. Predictably, she was eventually used up by her suitors, cast aside, and God tells the jilted Hosea to seek her out again and love her still. This is the most tender part of the story. And you see the bulleted point there. Hosea finds Gomer at the slave market, ready to be sold. Hosea buys her for 15 pieces of silver and 8 bushels of barley. The going price for a slave was 30 pieces of silver. Since Hosea didn't have that much, he offered barley too, and barley is a poor man's grain. You don't hope to have barley in your pantry. You hope to have wheat. But if you don't have much money, then barley is what you get. So Hosea is essentially, evidently, giving all he has. All the silver he has, and that's not enough. So you give whatever grain you have, barley in this case. And that's what it took to get her back. Again, I provided some verses for you. So at the bottom of that page, chapter 2, verse 1. Say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruama. Plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife. Neither am I her husband. That's divorce language. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight. And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they are the children of whoredoms. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. After a while, they're not coming to her. She's pursuing them, and they just want to get away from her. She's lost her beauty. She's lost her charm. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. And then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband. For then was it better with me than now. Chapter 3. Then said the Lord unto me, go yet, love a woman, beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons, we'd say pitchers of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for an omer of barley and a half omer more. And that's how he gets her back. What a poignant story, because here we have Gomer at the slave market. Nobody wants her. She's used up. She's old. She's lost whatever beauty she once had. And nobody can recognize beauty in her anymore. So she's at the slave market. And she has been nothing but bad for Hosea. But Hosea goes to the slave market and essentially gives everything he has to bring her back home, which is an amazing and great story. Of course, that's the story of Christ and his church. We had no charm. We had nothing to offer the Lord. And when we were in the slave market needing redemption, then we got a redeemer. Jesus came and he gave everything he had to buy us back. And that's why we have salvation today. Jesus is the greater Hosea and we are Gomer. We are the unfaithful wife. What I thought about when I was putting these thoughts together was the unusual ways that we are unfaithful to the Lord. There are many things that we do in unfaithfulness to God. Of course, the most obvious would be if we left the faith, if we're just not going to be faithful to the Lord in the sense that we renounce the Christian faith. And that happens from time to time. One of our friends or another would just drop out. Well, I'm not going to serve the Lord anymore. I'm done. Even if we don't do that, however, and I was thinking in the Wednesday night crowd, we probably don't have a lot of people who are about ready to renounce their faith, although I understand that that could happen. But that's probably not the temptation that you and I are going to have. When it comes to being unfaithful to the Lord, our temptation is probably going to be along the lines of loving something or someone in competition with God. So, what is it that attracts us? What do we love? What allures us away from our Lord? And remember that if you love your wife best of all, men, but you also love somebody else, another man's wife, a girl off on the side, quite a lot, maybe just not quite as much as you love your wife, that is unfaithful. The Lord deserves our undiminished loyalty, our absolute loyalty, a loyalty that has no competitors. So what are our competitors? What do we find ourselves lusting after? What do we find ourselves longing for? So you want to go back to Egypt, huh? The Lord brought you out. You want to go back. What is it that's pulling us back? So let's talk about that. Give me some ideas. What is it that is pulling our hearts away from the Lord if we let our guard down? Examples? Mike. Good. Elaborate. Mike says praise of others. Elaborate on that, Mike. Sometimes at the workplace or wherever, when you are more interested in the praises of the people around you than you are with the praises of God. Other suggestions, or add to that, What pulls you away, Joanne? Yeah, sometimes it's just a desire for rest and comfort, to just not be so intense all the time. And there's a place for rest and comfort, you know, don't get us wrong. But there's also a time when you have the distinct impression from the Lord that you're supposed to be engaged in a particular thing, and you're essentially saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Teresa and I were talking yesterday about the unusual phenomenon in Christian experience that causes people to withdraw from one another. So, for example, if you are in a Christian gathering, you sort of expect new people to sit down somewhere and stay to themselves because they're new, maybe they're young, something like that. But at some point, you're hoping that those Christians who sort of just sit down and stay to themselves would not do that. You're hoping that they would use this as a fishing hole, and they would always be fishing, trying to see who they can help, who they can encourage, who they can take under the wing. And that takes a lot of energy. So Joanna's saying it's a lot easier just not to do that. And it's really easy just to sit and hope that somebody comes up to you, which is fine at a certain level in your Christian life. But it's not fine to stay there. You are supposed to be the one who is constantly lifting others. I'll lift you, I'll lift you, I'll lift you, and I'll run from person to person, and I'll lift these people. I'm going to lift them because that's what Christians do. It is like your calling. You have to take people under your wing. You have to lift them. It's what we do. You think, wow, it just requires so much intensity. And that's true. It does require a lot of intensity. But Teresa and I are talking. It's like, what happens in a person's mind? Where is it that they just sort of stop growing? Think, well, I just have these few friends and I'm going to stick with them. And I'm not going to any longer try to lift the next person. You know, what I want to do is X, and I'm going to do that. And if people come to me, that's fine. They can come to me and I'll chat with them. But I am not going to take the initiative and go to them. And when you do that, you drop off the intensity. It's a little bit like dropping off the intensity of your romance with the Lord. You know, whatever happened that you just began to take God for granted and you thought, well, I'm not really going to work at this romance anymore. From now on, you know, I'm just going to kind of sit tight, let other people take care of business. All right, I understand that. But you know what happens in a marriage, don't you? If you decide to just drop off the intensity. After you drop off the intensity for a while, it's really easy just to kind of grow cold and grow apart. And then who knows what happens on a certain day when a temptation comes along and you just cave in. So the dropping off of intensity is step one to spiritual adultery. That's step two. And you don't want that to happen. Okay, what else? What is attracting us away from God? What is the attraction out there, Tom? Yeah. You know, we find ourselves conflicted here because on the one hand, you see the disintegration of family all over America and the world. And so we are family people. But, you know, even the worst of people are good to their family members. It doesn't take a lot of Christian courage to side with your spouse, to side with your kids. The worst unbelievers side with family. It takes a lot of spiritual courage to go outside your family and love the people who are not in your family. That's where the courage comes in. Now, of course, it takes some courage in this cultural milieu to be faithful to your family. But faithfulness to family, in a sense, I mean, that's a no-brainer. Everybody loves family. The people you don't love are the people who are out there. Everybody loves family. Jesus might say something like, do not even the Gentiles do that? I mean, it's easy to give to somebody who's going to give back to you. Anybody can do that. But how about giving to somebody who's not going to give back to you? So in a sense, family is the easy part, though maybe not so easy now as it used to be. But in a sense, family's the no-brainer. What's bigger than that is to go outside your family and make a dent. See, that's hard. So, as Tom is saying, why is it that, you know, we have to take Sunday off to go on a picnic with our families? Or whatever happened to Saturday? Or all those other days you took sick time or leave time or whatever you call it. Why wasn't that for family? I mean, you land on Sunday. Oh, well, that's going to be family time. Why does Sunday have to be family time? Pick some other time to be family time. Or also family time, but not only family time on Sunday. And so many things like that. Why did you choose this time to lock into family when you might have done something very special for the Lord? And yes, I think that's a problem. Teresa. Yeah, Teresa's talking about all of the marathons and fun runs, walkathons. Everybody's decided to do those at 11 o'clock Sunday morning now. And so why 11 o'clock Sunday morning? Was there no other time to do this? But it's always that time that gets captured instead of some other time. And we're not saying that you can't do that. You know, there's a legal obligation. But we're saying be careful about that, because maybe that's your competition. There's always something to do on Sundays. We're, you know, the soccer. Yes. Soccer on Sundays. All the racing stuff, you know, if you like the cars and motorcycles, that's a Sunday thing. If you got to go to the NFL game in Washington, then you're going to have to miss church so you can get to Washington and watch the Redskins or whatever we're talking about. Everything is Sunday. And pretty soon, to be honest, we just think, yeah, it doesn't really take much to knock me out of church. I have a sniffle. Or my neighbor has a sniffle. I better not go. And the next thing you know, every reason is a reason not to worship. And that's a problem. Shannon. So Shannon is bringing up the idea of the security that money can bring. And there's definitely, you know, in our uncertain times, there's definitely a temptation to put money first and to let money compete with God to give you a sense of security. And as Shannon is saying, there's no way that money can ever secure you. Only God can do that. And yet, the temptation is to turn your focus to money. So, you know, compare that. How often do you check your bank accounts and see how your investments are doing compared to self-examination of your heart? Are you checking your heart to make sure everything is good between your soul and the Savior more than you're checking your bank accounts? I mean, is the money just, has it become precious to you? I mean, money is money, but we always say a lot of things in life are more important than money. Do you live like that? Do you think about money all the time? Or you think about the Lord all the time? Do you pray without ceasing or double check your funds without ceasing? What is your focus? What is your mentality? And definitely money competes with the Lord. You see that in so many ways. And I'm not saying that women cannot work, but how many times has the thought of a dual income been so attractive? You think, well, I could raise these children or I can make an extra $2,000 a month. Goodbye, kids. And I'm not saying that there's not a cause for you to have two incomes sometimes. That's fine. You know, work it out with the Lord. But I'm saying my fear is that a whole lot of people are going to be sorry someday for the decisions they made because they sat there and they weighed the possibilities to invest in the little people that run around in my house or to invest in a larger IRA. And I chose the IRA. The same sort of thing when you drop the kids at daycare. Not that you can never drop your kids at daycare, right? I mean, there's a place for that. But I'm saying, how many times have we chosen to do that? Same thing again with working terrible hours. Do you know that it might have been wise for you to become a welder and punch that time clock at the end of the day, 5 o'clock, and go home, be a family man and a church man, make only $40,000 a year instead of working 60 and 70 hours a week Now, you can't really be a family man much or a church man much. So, but you sure made a lot more money. And at some point, and I'm not saying you can't work 60 or 70 hours a week, right? Just work it out with the Lord. Do whatever you want. I'm just saying, guard your heart, because maybe the deal here is you're torn between two masters and you can't love two masters. You cannot serve God and money. You just have to choose. And so choose well. Well, OK, so back to your notes. You see Arabic number 7 there. Hosea brings Gomer home as his wife again, convinces her to be faithful for the rest of her life. Chapter 3, verse 3. I said unto her, thou shalt abide for me many days. We're going to have a long time here. You stay with me. Thou shalt not play the harlot. You're not going to be a prostitute anymore. And thou shalt not be for another man, only me, as long as we both shall live. And that's what I will be for you. And so she is brought back home as a true wife, no more of this on again, off again, interested in Hosea, interested in somebody else. Arabic 8. In the end, we're going to have some name changes. So at the end of the story, Jezreel's name is still God plants, but now instead of God planting judgment, God is planting blessings. And then Lo Ruama, no mercy, her name is going to be changed to Ruama, mercy. And Loami, not my people, will have his name changed to simply Ami, my people. And so everybody has a name change. So chapter 1, verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered, shall come to pass in the place where it was said unto them, you're not my people. There it shall be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah, the children of Israel, be gathered together, appoint themselves one head, the two nations, north and south, brought together. They shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. So Jezreel was once God plants judgment. Now Jezreel is God plants mercies. God plants blessings. And so God is still planting, but everything is turned now. Then you see chapter 2, verse 1, I've listed for you under Arabic 8 there. And say unto your brethren, Ami. So it used to be Lo Ami. Not my people. What's your son's name? He's not mine. Now, what's your son's name? Ami. He's mine. He's my people. So say to your brethren, Ami. And to your sisters, Ruama. Used to be Lo Ruama. No mercy. Now it's mercy. They're all the brothers and sisters, all the children of God, are my people and people upon whom his mercy, God's mercy, is shed. Verse 2. Plead with your mother. Plead. Chapter 2, verse 21. Shall come to pass in that day. Whenever you see in that day, you're probably talking about the day of the Lord, which we call the tribulation and millennium stitched together. It shall come to pass in that day. I will hear, saith the Lord. I will hear the heavens. They shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn. So we're going to have lots of agricultural prosperity. The earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil. They shall hear Jezreel. Jezreel, I plant. And now look at the corn and the olives and the grapes. They're all growing. Verse 23. And I will plant unto me in the earth. And that's a play on Jezreel's name, right? God plants. And I'll have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And that's a play on Lo Ruama's name. And I will say to them which were not my people, you are my people. A play on Loami's name. And they shall say, thou art my God. So everything has changed. The Lord has brought home his wife. The children are all back safely at home. And that is the entire idea to the story. So you see Arabic number 9 there. The point of Hosea's living object lesson is a restored romance between God and the nation of Israel. Now, we'll apply this to our own situation as Christians in just a moment. But look at the first application. What is going to happen in Israel's future? Chapter 3, verse 4. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king. This is because of the captivity. Without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice. The temple has been destroyed. Without an image, without an ephod, without teraphim. Verse 5. Afterward, shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God. Now, they don't care anything about teraphim idols. They don't want any of that. They want the Lord their God. And David their king. Remember, in the millennium, it is actually possible that David will be resurrected. And so we're probably talking about the day of the Lord here again. And they shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days, what we call the end times. Chapter 2, verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. The Lord is going to romance us back. I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. And I will give her her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor. And that's great. Achor was named after Achan's trouble. Remember, he stole the Jericho treasures when he wasn't supposed to. Then they lost the battle at Ai. And he was put to death there in Achor. And it means trouble because he troubled Israel. The Lord says, I'm going to make the valley of Achor a door of hope. Isn't that great? For a door of hope. So what used to be trouble, a valley near Jericho. We don't know exactly where that valley is. There are lots of valleys near Jericho. So we don't know which one is the valley of Achor. But he's going to say, I'm going to take that place that used to say is trouble, trouble, nothing but trouble. I'm going to make that place a door of hope. It's all going to be right. It's going to be made right. And she shall sing there. Don't you love this? Again, this is like Gomer, but we're talking about the nation of Israel, which is like Gomer, the wife who was unfaithful. And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth. Isn't that great? It's just like freedom, liberated. Everything is right in the world. As in the days of her youth, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Verse 16, it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, which is my husband. The word Ish is man or husband. And shall call me no more Bailey, which is Lord and Master. But especially you see the connection between that word and Baal, the false god. And so it's better to take that word. And we're not ever going to say that again. Let's never use the word Baal, Master, again, because of its bad connotations. So the Lord says, you're going to call me your husband and not just your master. You're going to call me your husband. You hear the term of endearment there. Verse 17, for I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth. I don't want to hear that Lord and Master stuff, even though that's what it means. I don't want to hear that anymore. You will call me your husband, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day, millennium, tribulation, stitched together, in that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, with the creeping things of the ground. I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and will make them to lie down safely. No more war, no more predatory animals. Everybody's at peace. Verse 19, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and judgment and loving kindness and mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. So that's the future of Israel. All the world made right again. And again, we would call that the millennium when that takes place. For us, the lesson is great. The Lord is always trying to pull us back. If we've been unfaithful, if we've had our eye spun sideways toward money, the Lord is calling us back. I will allure her. I will speak comfortably to her. Come back to me. Don't live like that. If your gaze has been turned toward human relationships, human praise. Well, I have to dress like this or the boys won't think I'm pretty. I have to dress like this or people won't think that I'm successful. If your gaze has been turned to the praise of other people, the Lord is alluring you. Come on, stop that. Come back to me. Talk to me. Do it my way. The Lord is always trying to allure us and speak comfortably to us. And if we've been caught up in some hobby and the hobby is overdone, or we've been caught up in some kind of a career pursuit and that's overdone, or we've been caught up in some sort of a an attraction to the world, the internet problems, things that are happening in the world of Hollywood celebrities and the movie choices, the profanity, the club scene. I mean, whatever we're talking about. If we've been attracted to that, the Lord is trying to allure us back. Now stop it. And if we will come with him, remember how he said at the end of that, I will betroth thee unto me in loving kindness, in mercy. I just want you back and everything's going to be fine. I'm a forgiving God. Yes, you've messed up, but come back. don't mess up and stay away. Mess up and come back to me. And so that's the lesson of Hosea. How many times would you have just hated a person like Gomer? Like, get out of my sight. I never want to see you again. And God could have done that with us. But instead, he says, come on back now. And you and I, we're going to have something great. We're going to have something great forever. Come on back. And that's the great lesson of Hosea and Gomer.